Well, let's go back to 1975. You're 15 and you're 17?
I think I was 19.
19. Okay, so there's a 4 years difference, I guess. And how did you get entangled with, well, I guess, were you entangled with the soup bean people before SOC?
Not exactly. It all kind of happened at the same time. I was writing as a teenager and sent some of my poems to Mountain View, which was a little magazine that Appleshaw was putting out. And at the time, the editor was a guy named Don Askins. And about the same time I had sent my poems there, the Southern Appalachian Writers Co-op was forming. And so poems were accepted, and I got a call probably a month or two later. I had to come down to a meeting of this group. And people who were there were Don Askins, who is now a lawyer living in Virginia. Near where he grew up, and I don't think his writing at all these days. We're really connected with any of that. Peggy Hall, who is still connected with SOC. Jim Webb and Bob Baber didn't make it that particular meeting. I didn't meet Baber until I moved to West Virginia the next year or later that year, and didn't meet Jim Webb until a couple of years after that. Ron Short, who is still with Appleshaw for Roadside Theater. Dave Morris, I don't know what happened to Dave these days, but Dave is actually who got me to Antioch, because at the time that I went to the meeting, I had decided that I was going to quit high school at 16. I would be 15 then. And Antioch Appalachia was a branch of Antioch College, of the Southern Appalachian Circuit in Beckley, West Virginia, and they were so desperate for students that would take anyone. So I talked about that at that meeting, and they told me about the school. I applied a month or so later, and that's what it took to. On the condition that I got my GED prior to graduating.
Mm. Why did you decide to quit high school? Did you just have enough of it?
Well, Renee had set the example.
I didn't say that.
A few years before. Yeah, I mean, I think that I felt older than everyone there, and it was accepted within the family to kind of give it up at a certain point as long as you went on and continued your education some other way. So I just did it. I felt trapped.
Did you share the same experience in high school then?
Yeah, I felt pretty alienated, I guess. I did the same thing in terms of leaving high school early and going to college, but I wasn't as brave as Paulette. I stayed home. I went for 2 years to the junior college and then came on to UK.
Well, I didn't have any choice, though, if I was going to be in college, because you were the last of the group that was allowed to.
Oh, okay. Well, see, I don't think. See, my perception of it is that Paulette is very daring and brave and goes away from home at age 16, but it was really neat. But
right after Renee had been done it, the college struck a deal with the local high school and did not accept or let anybody else, students, anymore, unless, you know, finished college or got their GED. So
high school is scary because I know many people have bugged out too and went on. Okay, so that was in 75 then that this was going on?
Yes.
Okay, then did you move to Beckley to
I moved to Beckley.
To college then?
Yeah, this would have probably, this meeting I guess would have been in the spring, I think. Spring of 75.
So this is one of the real early meetings then?
This was like the second or third meeting. It was right at the beginning. And so in October of that year, I moved to West Virginia, to Beckley. And there was already a little magazine, a little literary magazine going on there that had What's a Nice Little Girl Like You, that maybe two issues had been published at that point, a poetry issue and a short story issue.
I've got all these checkbooks, by the way, if you ever want to see them. Everything she's mentioning, I've got them all.
Oh, well, I'll definitely take advantage of your archives.
And I didn't bring any of them like I meant to.
But I have them. I have them all. I think I have almost everything that ever was that I could, that you gave me, though.
And Bob Snyder, I mean, it just kind of happened that the college attracted a bunch of writers. And Bob Snyder, who is a writer, poet, was the director of the college. Pete Lasko was another poet who was one of the teachers there from Beckley. Bob Baber ended up at Antioch. I'm not really sure how. I don't know if you know one time or another. But, Gail Ann Berkey, Dave Morris, I already mentioned. Joe Barrett. Mary Joan Coleman, a bunch of folks.
Well, when this group was coming about being formed and it was kind of in its vocal stage and nobody knew anybody and you guys were just starting to meet each other, how did it, was there already a group there when you arrived or was it congealing? Because it seemed like it's a real close-knit group of people who were involved in it.
Well, there was a group congealing there and but I mean, the Soup Bean Poets, which is what that group later became, particularly of the ones I've mentioned, Baber, Amberge, Snyder, Laska, and myself, were kind of the core of the Soup Bean Poets. But SOP was really something else. I mean, there were some members of the Soup Bean Poets who were connected to SOP, and others who really weren't. I mean, there was a lot of things going on in little pockets throughout mm-hmm. the mountain. Lots of little magazines all over.
Do you have any theories? Either do you have any theories or reasons? So that's one thing I've noticed as I've gone back and looked at all these magazines. I used to be things like Twigs, Mountain Review, Mountain Life and Work, Plow with Nice Hillbilly. All these magazines, and now it seems like the population of these magazines has kind of dwindled downward. Or maybe there's just so few of them that I don't know. I was thinking about like Now and Then, High Mountain Sand and Gravel. But I couldn't really come up with too many more than that.
They're bigger. There's less of them, but what's there is bigger. I mean,
and I think probably more solid. You know, less likely to disappear overnight. You know,
yeah.
What's there now. I think it was partially indicative of what was going on in the country as a whole. I think it was a real time of small press activity and small groups of people empowering is the word they use now all the time, but coming together to publish themselves. You know, I think there was more feeling that it was okay to be regional. You know, you didn't have to make the big time or whatever in order to publish and to give each other support. Do you think? I mean, I don't know specifically what happened.
That makes sense.
I mean, I don't want to denigrate what was happening in Appalachia because it was really, really important, but I think that you also saw it with women's literature,
mm-hmm.
With black literature, with other types, with Chicano literature, with other groups coming together to publish and try to find a place where people could have a voice that hadn't had one before.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of sense. Also, I think just within the context of the mountains, that it was a time where people were kind of more on the grassroots level, were beginning to become aware of cultural issues and positive things about being Appalachian. It's ethnic groups were in.
Okay, that's what I was about to say. Yeah.
It's,
can you all remember when you first identified yourself as a member of ethnic group? Let's say you went to the UK and
I fought against it. Paletta. Really, I think through having that positive experience with a group of writers, you know, who were articulating all of these things, came to it a lot quicker than I did. I was real ambivalent for many years about having an Appalachian identity. You know, I didn't want to be pigeonholed or stuck in with a group. You know, I thought I was very sophisticated and European. I mean, you know, I just don't just read regional literature. I read all kinds of stuff, you know. I think it took me a lot longer to have an integrated view of who I was that incorporated that identity, you know, to not run from that identity, but to see how strong a part of me it really was. Mm-hmm.
What about you, Susan?
For me, it was clearly, you know, getting involved with a group of people who were kind of forming their own identity and finding what fit for me. And I think it took longer for me to find what didn't fit, that I was young enough that I tended to accept it more whole cloth. And then as I got older, I was able to look at it a little more analytically and figure out, you know, what in my experience had been different and made differences in my perception. You know, the other thing I want to go back to, though, is because I think that it was a lot more than just ethnic groups being in, although it certainly felt that had all of a sudden become acceptable. It was a time in the mountains where there was a lot of unity around various issues. And I think empowerment probably is a very good word for that. In that, for the first time, people were beginning to believe that they could do something about powers that had affected them all their lives. Strip mining, coal companies, union busting, and were looking to kind of their history and their parents' history of fighting, you know, those kinds of continuing powers and pressures mm-hmm. from the outside as a strength, and the Southern Appalachian Circuit of Antioch College were very political, and it wasn't just, I mean, people weren't. It wasn't art for art's sake,
mm-hmm.
For better or worse. It was art as a voice.
I want to read you something that I found was really, I think is very indicative of this. I found it, this is a little, have you ever seen this pamphlet? This is a pamphlet for the Southern Appalachian Writers Cooperative. It's a little nice brown paper folded over.
No, I haven't seen it.
And so this is something that has got, this great quote. By Bertolt Brecht, but I never had to say his name. And it goes, nowadays, anyone who wishes to combat lies and ignorance and to write the truth must overcome these five difficulties. He must have the courage to write the truth when truth is everywhere opposed, the keenness to recognize it, although it is still everywhere concealed, the skill to manipulate it as a weapon, the judgment to select in whose hands it will be effective, and the cunning to spread truth among such persons. And is that kind of the tone that people had?
Yeah, I remember that kind of, yeah. At the time I had, you know, I also had real ambivalence about the interaction between politics and art. I mean, to me it was a real problem when Pauletta was first into all this. I wasn't sure. I can remember getting really upset and angry and not being sure what the relationship should be between politics and art. I mean, I was afraid somebody was trying to cram a truth down my throat that wasn't mm-hmm. necessarily my truth. And was distrustful of political rhetoric, even if it was on the right side or on the left side, whatever. You know?
eventually, then you came back later on to work with Mountain Review, didn't you?
Yeah, and I think as the years have passed, I've become probably more, you know, even more. I believe the stuff that you just read by Brecht even more now than I did when I was 21 or even when I was working for Mountain Review. I think I've grown in that kind of political identity, and the political and personal have come closer for me as I've gotten older. I mean, I think there are ways to hold them together. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a very difficult task.
Yeah.
It's an important one.
Mm-hmm.
Silent part. So this unity, the strip mining, the Vietnam War, things like the flood in Tug Valley.
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading a poem by yours called Martyr, and...
Actually, that was written before all of this.
Well, now, how did you come to get involved in these, like, let's say this publication's come up, someone said, where Bob Henry Baber and Jim White get together and they say, we're going to do this thing to fight back. And how did the, what kind of contact did you have? And did someone say, Pauletta, you know, there's this magazine going on? And...
No, it was a lot looser than that. And I think the other thing, I mean, it's like some of us lived in Beckley, some of us lived in Virginia, some of us lived wherever. But people in the mountains are used to distances in order to see each other, and it was a closer-knit community than the miles between us would have led one to believe. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like because Jim and somebody were living in Williamson, they were starting this magazine kind of in a vacuum and people would hear about it. It was kind of more of a group, mm-hmm. a group process that this magazine would begin. It may have began as an idea with certain people, but then they would take it back to the group for the idea to really blossom. You know, I heard about Mountain Life and Work. Mountain View. And that was something that was very separate to me. I heard about it. I sent poems off to it. But most of the rest of it, after that time and after I went to Beckley and became involved with all of this, it wasn't like hearing about something and sending mm-hmm. something off to either be accepted or rejected. It was more of a
these were all people who you
process,
knew.
Right.
Who would meet with. What were the tenors of, what was the tone of getting together? Like, was a bunch of friends getting together to talk about things and...
It is now. In the early days, there was a lot more attempt at being formal about it. At having, what do they call it? The coordinating committee or something.
They had bylaws.
Yeah, they actually had bylaws. Incorporated as a nonprofit corporation. Annual meetings. I mean, this might have lasted like
2 minutes.
I was going to say 6 months.
Yeah.
But then after the real connections formed,
it was impossible to remain that formal with each other.
It was impossible to remain that formal. And you know, the other thing that I think is that soft has become both a lot more and a lot less than what people thought it would be at the beginning. I mean, I think at the beginning, people thought of it as being a corporation, you know, a nonprofit corporation, this fairly formal group that would publish books and would do advocacy and would you know, have this kind of.
You had the Apple Shop model to look at, too, which actually did incorporate and function as a nonprofit.
Right. And would just have this kind of solid, separate existence and would do all of this stuff. And that never happened. I mean, that wasn't a very realistic goal. What did happen is that, you know, 15 years later, there's still something that causes SEPSOC, and that there's a lot of little things that are going on and then some bigger things that are going on all over the region and outside of the region that have happened wholly or in part because of the strength that people have gotten from the connection with either SOC itself or with people who were involved in SOC. But there are no bylaws or dues or Carcurian members, and there's no corporation. And, you know, SOC itself is no more closer to kind of having joined the mainstream of published writers. And there are individuals within SOC who have received some mainstream recognition, but for the large part, people have carved out their own little niches for And I don't think that that's what people originally, I don't think people originally would have seen that as being an acceptable problem.
Really? Why not?
Because the perception was we need to find, you know, our place in the New York publishing scene, or the whatever, you know, that we need to find traditional ways of making our livelihood out of this, and we need to have a broad, you know, a nationwide, national base of readership, and there are certain ways in which this is done. But as people went on, you know, and as years went on, I think what people discovered is that no, we can, you know, we can be successful and reject what we don't want out of, or what we don't need out of the New York publishing scene. You know, there are other ways to measure success.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a long lesson to learn. I think that everybody has to push themselves through. There's this, from the first issue of a Mountain Review, Gurney has this little introduction. He's talking about, like what he thinks are the goals of this new Mountain Media, which is arising, this new media all over the nation. It's 1974, so I guess it's an old media by this point, or it's in its maturity. And he talks about that, okay, it's our job to provide it, now it's up to see what people are going to do with it. And that there's a growing reluctance among the Mountain people either to join the national gluttony or to be the object of it, which seems to be kind of the lesson that you're talking about. Looking a bit more downscale at the relationships going on, and what was can you talk about some of its personal importance to you, or how it helped shape some of your artistic ideas? And your own friendships, particularly I noticed, like with Gail Ambergy and Mary Jo Tolman, is that her name?
Yes.
And that you guys did several small booklets together. Mm-hmm. And was there a real tight-knit friendship also underneath of all that?
Well, Gail and Mary Jo and I only did the one, and that was never a particularly tight-knit friendship, but which I won't go into. But Gail is a different story, and we're still very close now. And in fact, many of the people that I count among friends now are people that I know from school. Gail Ambergy, Peggy Hall, Bob Baber, Jim Webb. You know, it's those are connections that are still very, very solid and familiar to me. They will always be. You know, I think other than those friendships, one of the things that I really gained out of the experience with Supreme Poets and Sock is a sense of finding a common purpose with people that I like. You know, and I have not written in that way for many years, but I continue to search for ways to make something with people that I enjoy being with. Theater groups, environmental groups. You know, it's my life has been a kind of a constant moving from kind of one little group to another, often with the same people in them, but with different kinds of purposes as time goes on.
Oh no, that's just my watch going off. It makes this obnoxious beeping noise 24 hours a day. I've just grown to ignore baby. I was like, alarm. Well, let's do this. Let's go through, and from like, if you guys can bring me through what just kind of like basic where you were and what was going on from 74 to now. I think that would be a helpful thing to show that this was just a part of a small part of life, and that you, other, you know, you moved to, eventually both of you moved off. Renee moved back and then moved back again.
Yeah, I've been running around in circles.
And I'm real interested in that connection of leaving and of coming back, and of, I noticed that's the theme a lot of your early poetry too, back from when I've read from then, is this constant leaving and trying to find things and then coming to terms with that leaving. So lead me through some lives here.
Is there any way I can smoke a cigarette?
This is my parents' house.
That's all right.
They'll slay me if there's any smoke in it.
Don't worry, I'm
totally
still
in here.
Moms have the best noses.
They absolutely do. What's that I smell on you?
Okay, let's do
okay,
it.
Okay, you first, Renee.
Okay, 1974?
Oh, sure, whenever you want to start.
I've got to think. What was I? How old was I in 1974? I'm 35.
So 16, you're 19 then, right? In 74?
No, I guess I was 18. I guess I was getting ready to really leave home for the first time in 75. I left, I had 2 years of junior college at Lee's where my father taught in Jackson. I came to the University of Kentucky at about age 18. I lived in my own apartment the first time I'd been away from home. I was an English major.
What a fine thing that is.
What a fine thing to be. met and married a musician, somebody. We had a child at age 21. I don't know what are we up to, 1977?
We're getting close to Mountain Review.
Yeah, we are. After the birth of, just previous to the birth of my child, my husband and I moved back to Jackson where my parents lived. And I took a job in my mom's daycare so I wouldn't have to leave my baby when she was little.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept that job until about the time that, during the time that I was nursing her and wanted to be close with her. Then I started getting the urge to go back to school. I never finished. I quit college with maybe only two semesters left.
Oh, wow.
To finish my BA. And had the kid by choice. You know, I got pregnant on purpose, quit school on purpose, the whole thing, moved back. Then I started wanting to go back to school, or thought I did, got in an internship type program through Union College.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't actually get sent, but I was interested in literature and the whole, I knew all the stuff that was going on with Pauletta, was really excited by that. My husband and I made a trip down to Apple Shop to try to sell ourselves to them as interns. And so they hired me as an intern with Mountain Review Magazine. And he was also with Mountain Review Magazine to begin with. They then lost their editor, and I got the job. So I quit school again to take this full-time job as editor of Mountain Review. And my husband became director of the show Headwaters, which is still in existence.
Yeah.
And so he did that, and I edited Mountain Review. I had how to describe it. A valuable but also exasperating experience with Apple Shop as an organization. You know, I guess I'm much more comfortable with the way Sock has turned out in terms of personal relationships and all that.
Mm-hmm.
With Apple Shop, the magazine was very hard to find. It had traditionally been hard to find. In fact, they said I was their last editor. I mean, it was a lot of pressure on me. They said, if you want to do it, if you'll take it over, we'll keep it. But otherwise, we're just letting it go.
Wow.
And I had a real hard time building a base of support for the magazine, for a literary venture, even within the organization. It was very frustrating. There's much more emphasis on film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's a board of directors and everything, but because Apple Shop started out as a filmmaking group, the board of directors was probably 3/4 filmmakers, you know, one literary person, one TV person, two, you know, June Apple people. So it's really hard to get a core of support for literary ventures, even within the shop I found, which was real heartbreaking, I think. But Sock has done a lot more to further literary endeavors in the Appalachian region than Apple Shop ever did. I got really frustrated, and I missed Lexington, and we moved back to Lexington. Now we're up to... Do you want me to keep going?
Sure, yeah. This is exactly what I
want. Do you want to talk about Apple Shop?
When you were at Apple Shop, one of the things that that was going on at the same time is that George Ella and Bob Baber had done this Appalachian Poetry Project, and you were one of the coordinators for that. And you had a couple of meetings while you were there with some soft folks, didn't you?
Yeah, a couple. What I was trying to do was bring more, what we were getting and unsolicited to the magazine was basically a bunch of crap. We were getting stories about Grandpa and the barn and front porch and all that kind of stuff. And so I tried to more actively solicit material, you know, to get people to send me material to take advantage of this community of writers that was around us, you know, to ask people, can I have this poem? Can I do this? Can I do that? And I don't know.
Which was really kind of going more with the model that later developed. It's not
right.
So much, we are this magazine, send us your stuff. It's more kind of trying to be interactive.
Right.
So did you end up meeting a lot of the people who you were writing to and saying, you know, I've read your stuff and I'd like to meet you? And
well, a lot of them I already knew.
Oh,
you
well.
Know, through Pauletta. It was that kind of, you know, through her connection with Beckley and all that. There were people that I'd met and known too, although I wasn't at that time active in SOC like she was. You look like you, well, you
I was
look
just
like
thinking,
a mess
well, SOC, I was just thinking, was SOC really even active at that particular
well,
that time,
was,
which would be around 80, because that was kind of its dry period.
Yeah, I guess it
but
was.
But all the people were
but
still
But the people
there
who I was connected with
thing.
You and Bob Baber and Bob Snyder. I published things with Bob Snyder and they were different people.
Did you ever get any feedback from any of the readers in the magazine about the stuff that you published in it?
Yeah, we got some, and again, it was like there's two different lines going there. I mean, there are the people that read the magazine that wanted the stuff about, gee, how good it was in the old days and the old tradition, I mean, you know, and that kind of thing, mm-hmm. and loved kind of more sentimental type stories, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And looked to the magazine for that. And then there were people that I think wanted to see the magazine reflect more of the diversity that I truly believe exists in Appalachia too. You know what I mean? To not just once again present a stereotyped view of Appalachia,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And when I took over the magazine, it was my perception that with the goal being the opposite, what the magazine was doing was perpetuating the very stereotype that it set out to break.
Hmm. Wow.
By making it look like all hillbillies did was, I mean, if we painted a picture, we would paint a picture of a barn, you know, or a horse or a mule or a guy with a plow or whatever, you know. And that, boy, wasn't that great that we could reflect our culture. But the mountains have always been a lot weirder than that.
So how was this ever received by people who are used to this other format? Was there, oh my God, how dare you?
There wasn't an uproar. And there, you know, there were some comments, but there really wasn't any kind of furor.
Oh, that's
kind of
sad.
Yeah. More of the uproar was within Apple Shop itself.
Really? What were they afraid of?
I think they were afraid of losing the blue-haired ladies that read the magazine and liked to watch movies about people Whitman or something. I don't know. Their money.
Mm-hmm. Well, money's one of those
things
that at least it seems like that's something that SOC was managed and the Seeking Post supported themselves and were responsible to nobody for their money. And so could damn well do whatever they wanted.
We didn't
have any. So you're saying.
That's the thing about not having any money. And I don't feel that way really about Apple Shop. Now, at the time, I did have some bitterness. I had some problems with Apple Shop. I remember a couple of board meetings that I either left in tears or cried after I got home or whatever, just because I felt like they didn't understand what I wanted to do with the magazine.
Well, so was that the reason for its eventual last final issue? Was that just your lack of energy? Well, not lack of energy, but frustration?
Well, I couldn't get any help for them, for funding. There wasn't much funding for literary yet. I mean, it's much easier to get money for a film then and now, I think, than for a publication, you know, from NEA or wherever. It's just harder to get money for publications. And I didn't feel the support from them, and I was homesick for Lexington, and so was my husband. And so I just gave up, and they basically said, if you're not going to do it, we're, you know, we told you before, if you weren't going to do it, we were going to let it drop. So I just let it drop.
So now, Paula, what were you doing at this time? Where are you?
Well, I went to Beckley in 75 and stayed there for 4 years. And it's... There were a lot of things that kind of happened, a lot of kind of reshuffling and restructuring that happened during that period. I mean, SOC kind of as a organization fell apart after a couple of years. Obviously, it didn't stay falling apart, but at that time it was. And there were other kind of reshuffling and reforming. Soup Bean Poets established their own identity, published a few issues of What's Nice Little Billy Like You, and published Soup Bean. You know, Don Askins, who was kind of one of the big guys in SOC and the director of Mountain Review, left Appleshop, and so there wasn't like the same kind of Eastern Kentucky contingent there had been. A lot of the base of the operation that of what had been SOC kind of turned more to Jim Webb, who was in Williamson, and Bob Daber, who was in Beckley part of the time and Richwood part of the time. And they published a couple of little magazines that I know you know about. You said you did Nothing and Strokes came out during that period. And then the other thing that happened is that at the end of the 70s, Bob Baber, Bernie, and George L. Lyon got a grant to do something that they called the Appalachian Poetry Project. Has anyone talked to you about that?
Yeah. Well, Bernie, I've got interviews up with George L. to dig into that.
Yeah. Well, in some ways, that was kind of like the resurgence of all of this. I mean, there's been this up and down pattern, but, you know, kind of in the mid-70s, there was SOC, and there was a lot of meetings and gatherings and poetry readings across the region about that. And then, you know, that all kind of died down. And then in the early 80s, there was the Appalachian Poetry Project, which kind of got some people back together and then also formed new connections as well. During that period before while I was still living in Beckley, before I moved to Cincinnati, I went up to Cincinnati with the Soup Bean Poets to do a reading up there, and met Mike Henson and Dick Hay, and recorded those names along the way. And then after I moved to Beckley and the Appalachian Poetry Project happened, Mike Henson and I was a regional coordinator for a reading up there. And Dick came to that reading and met, you know, Bob Baber and Gil Amber, you know, a bunch of other people who had kind of been connected with the old SOC, and so kind of new alliances began to form. And for a period of time, a lot of what happened around SOC happened either in Cincinnati or with the Cincinnati base. Dick Hay and I worked on some things.
What are some things? Give me an example. Some
well, stuff it's we started it again, I guess, in 19, 1982 or 83, doing the yearly SOC gathering at Highlander.
Yeah.
People would get together once a year and do that. Pine Mountain Sand and Gravel happened out of Jim bringing the idea to a meeting at Highlander and then doing that. Dick and I organized some readings in Cincinnati And so people got together around that. There was a reading at Apple Shop that Jim Webb organized. The other thing that happened to bring kind of new groups of people together was some of us went in the early part of the 80s every year to the Hindman Writers Workshop. Mm-hmm. And that's where I really got to know Peggy Hall, although I had met her before. Peggy and Gail and I, you may not have heard of this, but we were published in 1976 in a article about Appalachian women writers.
In this magazine?
Yeah. And at the time of the article was written, none of us knew each other. But then, before the article was published, I met Gail. I mean, we just happened to go to Antioch, because mm-hmm. she was not at Antioch at the time it was published, I don't think. Maybe she had already gone there for one summer, but I wasn't at the time it was written and, you know, researched and written, and I hadn't either, but we met each other by that time. And then I met Peggy a few years later. None of us know who the fourth woman is. I don't know.
Okay, I'll hire a private
detective.
She's never shown up.
You'll meet her later on in life.
Possibly.
She'll show up.
And another person who went in the early part of the 80s pretty regularly to the to Hindman Writers Workshop was Jerry Woman Williamson, who's the editor of Appalachian Journal. And so then he started publishing a lot of the people who were in SOC. You know, during that time, Decay published there, I published there, Jim Webb published there. He did the bibliography. Georgella published there, although I imagine Georgella probably had been published in Appalachian Journal before then. And so that kind of, for a while anyway, became another voice for people who have been involved.
Well, I want to go back and talk about the final issue of Mountain Review, which now you guys have been you dragged Pauletta into Mountain Review in the last couple of issues. You were poetry editor mm-hmm. now, and this is a poem from the final issue, which I want to get you to read out loud, that you had written, mm-hmm. and which seems to me to get everything that was going on, and we can talk about it a little bit more when we talk about it.
Okay. You want me to read it now?
Yeah, read it and let it go.
Eastern Kentucky road closed. He said, I can't leave. If I did, one of these days I'd be driving down that road, singing about home, and I'd hit the county line and there'd be a sign saying, road closed. Turn back, boy, you ain't going home because it is no more. You know, I left once, but the mountains would not let me go, and I came running home like a child that heard his mother call, like a bird that smelled the scent of spring, but it was not there. Just like Mama ran off with some no-count man, and spring will not come again. It's a land that is sinking, drowning, all the while embracing the hands that hold it down. And I can't stand to stay, but I can't bear to leave before it's gone, until the mountains disappear with one small fire. So girl, if you're leaving, just be sure to know that what you see now you will not see again. Just be prepared as you hit that county line, singing about home, to come upon a sign saying, road closed.
What kind of thoughts does that bring to mind or feelings for you all?
Well, you know, I think to a certain degree that what we saw really wasn't there anyway. It's I think that that I, during a certain period, romanticized the mountains even while I was living in them. And kind of had this fixed idea in my mind of kind of what the connections were, you know, who SOC was, what I was in connection with that, and that if anything, in leaving, although it could have been a figurative leaving as well as an actual leaving, but in kind of getting some distance from it and reassessing my connections with the mountains and with the people there and the people I knew that have really gone strong, but it's just more realistic community.
I think it's something that came on with maturity too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I think that that's why it could have, you know, it could have been a figurative leaving as easily as it was an actual leaving. But as it was, you know, what I chose to do was to leave and stay at home. So it's, you know, I don't feel any real sadness or, you know, any real thinking that's there anymore. And it would still be there if only I had stayed and, you know, kept it going or whatever. I don't feel any sense of that. And, you know, I think for perhaps an earlier generation, that may be true, that, you know, people who left the mountains in the 50s, 60s, or even before, or I mean definitely before, that there was something there that is gone now, for better or worse. But for me, I mean, it was already the mountains and mountain culture and mountain life was already in such a state of transition that it wasn't like some fixed thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Renee?
I guess that was similar. The time that poem was published in the magazine was in there. It was a time of real disillusionment for me. You know, I think that by that time, I think Pauletta was starting to work through some of her ambivalence. I mean, she'd gone from the romanticizing of the mountains and that strong sense of community with other writers. I had gone from being real skeptical of it to coming more to terms with an Appalachian identity. And then, when I was trying to work through that, was running up against brick walls with people that were supposed to be doing, you know, having the same political, artistic, personal goals as I did. And I felt a real strong sense of personal failure about the magazine. And I was really ready to leave. You know, I was really ready to leave. But a lot of it was to just get the hell away from it, forget it, lick my wounds, whatever. And it was not until years later, after my marriage broke up and all kinds of things had happened, that I went to a meeting at Highlander, a soft meeting. And in that period of time since then, it's been real nurturing for me. It's been real important to me in the last 4 or 5 years.
Oh, well.
That I just, you know, I was running from that at the time. I really did have that feeling that this road is closed. Get the hell out of here, fuck this. You know?
Well, let's go to the nurturing times now then.
Let me just say too that
was me. It was a personal failure too. You know, I went into that cold. I didn't know what I was doing, but it was real important to me, and it didn't work out. And it was at a time, a real crucial time in my young adulthood.
And you just kind of got caught up by things that were happening, and whenever we do something or undertake a project, it's all our responsibility.
And I was the project director. I mean, I had to do everything just about for that layout, paste up everything.
I think that that's a real important thing to talk about. I mean, both the sense of personal failures that I think people have felt along the way, and then also just kind of the disillusionment and bumping up against, you know, in a negative way against people who are working for the same thing, because it certainly happened throughout the history of Sauk as I know it. I mean, it wasn't, there was a sense of community and support, but there was also just a lot of anger and infighting. It's, there was a real rift for a period of time between a lot of the people who were involved in Sauk and the Sauk poets, because of Bob Snyder's poems being inadvertently left out of the ground. Mm. And Bob never believed that it was an inadvertent burden. I think he was probably wrong. about that, but at any rate, it, you know, it was already kind of a tenuous relationship between him and some of the stronger forces within SAW, and that was enough to kind of send it over the edge. Antioch-Appalachia folded during that period as well, with Antioch kind of pulling back and pulling its funding and defunding some pretty much all of its branch colleges. But the other thing happened during that period of the university, it's Alaska. Bob Snyder and Alaska had a major blowout, mm-hmm. and that kind of ended the Supreme Court's. It's there was never a real easy alliance between many of the people at Appleshock who were doing film and music, and the writers in the region who felt that we were doing it. I could probably go on and on, with personal struggles and then kind of professional or political struggles, but. You know, when I look back, I tend to not so much forget that, but to not place a whole lot of importance on it because of, you know, how it's all kind of evolved and mended. You know, it's Snyder and Laska's struggle was a major breaking point at that period of time. Last year they published another book together. Jim Webb is now at Appleshock having made whatever piece that he feels like that he's needed to make, and I think feeling a certain amount of support from his publishing efforts as well as his efforts as someone trying to make a living in the mountains. You know, so it's over time those things mend, and it's not as if that there's you can't see the cracks, but the cracks just kind of add to the strength or to the particular face of the organization. Having had any kind of permanent change.
Definitely, it seems to me it's much like a group of a family, even who you disagree with people you live with, you hate them at times. You hate your best friends, you want to pound them, but at the same time, it's those sort of schisms and coming back together again mm-hmm. that really allow us to know each other instead of just saying, oh, we're so nice and nice to each other all the time, which is an impossible way to live a life.
And coming back together in new ways and in ways
we think that are
being able to wait for
me to tell you
what this connections mean.
Well, let's look just a little bit beyond the time that some of the seasons were starting to appear and that Mount Meiji would collapse. Now you're saying that this is the time where you both come to Cincinnati and that SAW was kind of being, done there with yourself and Richard Hay, and that so this was the beginning of this new of the not new era shit. of this
Of a reforming.
Where did that lead to?
Wherever we are now. I'm not sure where it led
to. Here's a compass.
I'm not sure where we are now. I think what it led to was a place where people are, where there are a lot of people doing a lot of things, either with or without the help of other people who've been involved in SAW, but in general, feeling supported and drawn upon and helping, drawing upon each other, but also helping each other. It's not a real easy group to describe, and I don't think it really is a group. but there is still a sense of connectedness. And I think connectedness with each other now, but also connectedness with the history and what kind of
Well, hopefully some vague answer will arise out of the interviews that I'm doing. Now, what I'm going to do is send around all the interviews to everybody else, and then, you know, I'm not going to do anything. I'm just hoping that the answers will kind of, well, not even an answer, but sort of a reflection will arise, where there might have been a more scattered one before. You were talking about how 4 years ago you started going to the annual SOC meetings again, how that was an important thing to you. Speak.
Well, I think after the experience with Apple Shop, I still was pretty young. You know, I think that was, just sitting here thinking about it and talking about it, I think that I realized how devastating it really was to me. I think it took me a long time to believe that I could be creative in that way again, or, you know, to act in that way. I think I decided after that fell that I was really a fake, you know, that it didn't work. I don't know. There was some really big
couldn't even be in Appalachian.
I couldn't even be in Appalachian. <Yeah, yeah, yeah. laughs> Can't do shit. And there were some really, really bad years for me personally, financially, a lot of different ways. A real turning point for me was when I went to a meeting in Highlander with Paulette and friends of ours that year. I don't know. It must have been, I guess it was just before I turned 30, and I'm almost 35 now. I felt, even though I didn't have anything there to read, you know, I didn't have anything to show off with. I really didn't have anything to show for myself. I felt so accepted and nurtured, and felt like that it was a place to talk. And I got so excited about what other people would read and what they were doing again, and started to feel my little editor blood start going again or whatever, you know, because I've always had a sense of being able to identify and work with other writers and nurture in that kind of way myself, you know, that I had lost and was regaining. I went back to school. I started the fall after that. I made the plunge, took loans out and all that stuff, was a single parent by that time. Went back to school. So I stayed more in touch with this being that Peggy Hall was my roommate while we were in graduate school. We lived together. Peggy Hall came here and lived with me, went to a social work program, and I went into library science. And as I've grown in this connections with these people and the writing and connections that I've made through the university, I even feel stronger about stuff that's ready to come out of me in terms of my own writing. You know, I don't feel so much like that my role will just be to find and nurture and publish other voices, that I've developed more of a sense of my own voice and what I want to say about me and Appalachia and men and women and lots of different things that are all just tangled together personally and politically. But I just feel like that this year was real important to me. This year in Highlander, real important to me.
Well, that's something I'm trying to, I missed the meeting by 1 week. Gurney told me it was in November. So I would really like to hear about your experience down there.
Well, did you know what the theme was this year? It's not
dangerous
at all. Yeah, it's all different. And the person that organized it this year, I thought that was just really brilliant. I think that it ended up working really well. And once again, it wasn't real structured. You know, there wasn't a program or anything like that. There was just kind of the unifying theme of dangerous words. And I think the adrenaline, the energy that we all got from her letter that she sent, that she and Joe Carson sent, that was so passionate about continuing to speak. And the things that people talked about and read were all over the board. You know, from Jewish experience to the experience of an older woman thinking about, who's been active in the Socialist Party for years and years, been very active politically, thinking about the summer that was a turning point for her sexually and politically.
Wow.
And having been afraid to share that chapter of her memoirs that she's working on, to short stories, to poems, to, you know, just all over the board. And I found a lot of those people's, met some new people too who hadn't been there before. And I just found what they shared really moving. Exciting. And one thing we decided, next week we're going to have a week-long retreat before it, that Aline, the lady I was just speaking of, and she and I are
going to work on organizing that.
Wow.
For people who want to have a week to work on stuff before, you know, the weekend of reading and being more social. So, you know, I'm almost ready to feel like that I am one.
You are one.
I don't know what you is.
We don't know where I am, but it's coming more together. And it really is a lot of because of these experiences that I carry around with me. This Elaine, for example, I met the first time that I went to Highlander. She was there, and I hadn't seen her again since then. And she was there this time. So there was that sense.
Well, that's a good thing. If you knew you'd be in trouble, undoubtedly.
Right, right.
Oh, well, what about the last 4 or 5 years for you, Paula? What's been going on? And in 30 words or less.
I have continued to be very involved in kind of issues around arts and culture. There's an organization in Cincinnati called the Urban Ecology Council. And Cincinnati is its population at this point is estimated to be about 1/3 of the population. Well, people who, you know, we're talking some first generation, but also second, third generation people. These families moved up for jobs and, you know, they ended up staying. And it's, I've been on the board there since probably 82 or 83, shortly after I moved to Cincinnati. And finding that that many of the same issues that people, and that people in the mountains in the 70s dealt with, probably still dealing with them, but the 70s was the last time I was there, are also being dealt with by people in urban areas, and urban areas and on a cultural level, I think issues around trying to define what it means to be Appalachian in the age of television, you know, the age of kind of homogenization. And in some ways, I think that at least for the people of lower income living in kind of identified Appalachian neighborhoods, that there are more distinct differences between urban Appalachians and kind of the wider culture, the Cincinnati culture, than there are between rural Appalachians and the wider culture. That is, that people have kind of had to band together and to have ended up not really assimilating in the same way that, you know, Breathitt County school kids may have assimilated with the wider culture by modeling themselves from out of whatever the teenage television programs are now. Like in
Pretty in Pink, movies like that.
Yeah. And then also just social issues, social justice issues. It's one of the larger issues in Appalachia has remained kind of environmental issues, strip mining, but now kind of a whole other level around that, you know, toxic waste dumps and whatever else is being dumped on the mountains. And those are similar issues to that low-income people have living in urban areas, and because a lot of the low-income population of Cincinnati is Appalachian, then it's become an urban Appalachian issue. Poor people living in factories and having to deal with that. So, I mean, that has been kind of how I've stayed connected, and it's been real helpful to me to be able to kind of draw on people who are doing the positions in the mountains, not just on kind of the SOC level, but also I've begun to connect with people out of Highlander Center and other communities who are doing the mountain issues as well. well. I still feel like I'm continue, no matter what I do, I'm continuing to draw upon the strength.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, that's what I've been doing.
Well, that's a lot to be doing, actually, I think.
Well, it's an interesting organization.
I never really, my first encounter with it, although it's, I don't know, I have the conflict of right now going into graduate school in social work and going to graduate school in English. And I don't know which is stronger. And I started off an undergraduate in social work. And moving into English because I couldn't resist the writing, but it's something I'll an organization like that I'll undoubtedly find myself entangled in.
Yeah.
Is there information on it down here in the Appalachian Center?
I would think so. I mean, I'm not sure, but I would think that maybe it would be.
Do you act as an advocate and as a whatever role?
I'm a board member at the Urban Appalachian Council, and so that means that there's not really a whole lot that I do in terms of direct service work or mm-hmm. advocacy with them. But I have also, over the last year and a half, been working with a group of mostly volunteers on an issue that's important to a particular Appalachian neighborhood about the environmental issues. And so that's kind of gotten me more connected with people in the neighborhoods and with acting as an advocate for people in the neighborhoods on a particular issue. But one of the things that UAC has done over the last couple of years, which I've had a lot to do with, is to kind of start defining what we want to do with our cultural work, which would include the arts. And so that's kind of brought me in touch, not so much on a, on an advocacy level or direct service work level, but more in terms of thinking these things through. You know, what is urban Appalachian culture? What? How do you define it? How do you promote it? And I think I don't have a definition to give you. I think that we're in the process of defining it. But part of in some ways you do have to promote it before you define it in this kind of sense, because if it's if you don't know what it is and what it means to people, then you go to the people who are living it to try and figure that out, and you do that by kind of helping people create indigenous art, mm-hmm. and that art tells you
something, yes,
about what that culture is. So I think that's somewhat in the process of doing that.
Well, I mean, that's going to be fun to see how it turns out. Mm-hmm.
It is
1:45. Oh, well,
so
it's late. Okay.
I have to pick my daughter up from the movies by 2:30.
By 2:30. Okay, that's fine. This has been. I really appreciate you all.